Welcome to the Avery Adventures podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Avery. Tanya's not with me today. She had to do something more important. Anyways, first things first, I want to thank everybody for their feedback. We're kind of blown away about the amount of feedback we have gotten from emails, from PMs, from Rockslide, from talking to people at the show on the podcast, and really want to say thank you. And again, people want to leave feedback. The easiest way to find us is probably AveryAdventures.com. If you like the podcast, please leave an iTunes review on iTunes and keep the feedback coming. We've had good feedback. We've had bad feedback. We've had a ton of questions. So in the near future, we will have a questions and answer kind of a podcast on the questions that keep coming up over and over again. One of the biggest questions I'll address right now is video. We fully intended to have video by now, but apparently I'm a video idiot. So by next week, most of our podcasts should be on video, and I hope that they're on video. So I will let you know on that. One of the biggest reasons we started this podcast is for the guest that we have on the show today. He's the kind of guy that's probably not going to be on a lot of podcasts, but he has a wealth of information. And that guy is Larry Bartlett. Larry Bartlett, the inventor of tag bags. He's also the owner of Pristine Ventures. He's out of Fairbanks, Alaska. I met Larry 3 years ago at the SHOT Show when he was helping out with Cryptic. He's the kind of guy that he would be just as comfortable in an intellectual argument as he would a bar fight. And he's one of the funniest guys you're ever going to meet. So without further ado, as Joe Rogan hates to say, here's Larry Bartlett.
Yo, Rock Slide, Larry Bartlett. So Ryan Avery asked me to participate in one of these podcasts, and be honest, I've never tried this shit before, so we'll see how it goes. I appreciate the interest in tag bags, and I'd just like to respond to some of the most common questions that we get concerning those synthetic game bags. And I don't know, maybe it'll give you an insight as to how the product came about and where it's headed. So here we go. How did the idea for synthetic game bags come about, and how did the market respond? Well, at first I had to overlook the naysayers and the old school hunting professionals who scoffed at the tag bags concept, and I trusted the scientific method to prove synthetics were superior to cotton. In early 2002, I demonstrated some basic homegrown science experiments and proof of theory studies with bacteria and mold on different material types. Then I was able to identify a specific nylon and polyester family with the ideal thread count for breathability and tear strength. Once I did that, I found a source for suitable fabric with just the right thread count and finish, and then began field testing actual game bags and studying bacterial spoilage parameters. Why nylon versus cotton? Well, nylon is 6 times lighter than cotton and dries something to the magnitude of 500 times faster than cotton. Bloodstains wash out easily, so the bags look new after years of use. And the small footprint of the complete set saves a huge amount of space in your pack. Cotton has been around for hundreds of years, and hunters have always liked cotton because it's cheap and widely available, easy to work with, and protects meat from the elements just fine. The problem is it gets heavy and bulky. I suggested there was more to spoilage, odors, and final taste than simply protecting meat from the elements. I had to prove how to control bacterial spoilage by limiting moisture and fostering drying, managing core temperatures, and then I had to prove how tag bags translate to higher yield and better tasting meat. And then there was the obvious price factor. All synthetic materials cost more because manufacturing requires petroleum-based processes that are controlled largely by oil prices. That I didn't know prior to getting into synthetic textiles. There was a huge resistance to mind change. And that period took about 5 years of diligence and more science-proven demonstrations before people started to believe in synthetic game bags. I used science to show how bacteria-infested elements like blood, pus and piss, even dirt and crap, all respond to plastic versus cotton fibers. I proved the efficacy of synthetic material by developing a game bag that has a lightweight and low bulk property, has adequate ventilation, quick dry properties, that washes and cleans easily in the field, which is rugged and reusable. My mental gears are always cranking out products and improvements with field efficiency. Save time, save weight, save energy, save long-term costs, those sorts of things. But what this means for me is that for every 10,000 good ideas I conjure up, less than one of those has any potential to be great. So maybe it's the process of creation with an intolerance for imperfection that inspires me to produce great products, and not so much market opinion that drives my motivation. The tag bags were a great idea, so I put steam behind it. Tag bags as an Alaska product. What are the challenges that limit growth of a brand born in Alaska? Short answer, cost of doing business. If you think about it, the reason Alaska was purchased from Russia for a penny an acre is because this giant North American geographic peninsula is remote, and it's cut off from the contiguous states by Canada, so supplies and operational costs have always been costly to successfully exist in Alaska. That hasn't changed. Couple that with a product that requires petroleum products to be made and which is reliant upon the oil and gas industries to deliver, the price tag will always be higher in Alaska. Tag Bags is a national brand. What was the catalyst that made Tag Bags a national brand? Well, the short answer is Aaron Snyder and Rock Slide. Aaron came to me one day and asked if I would consider making a specific set of game bags for elk and deer hunters who backpack into deep parts of public land, harvest an animal, and then debone it for transporting it back to the road. He had the dimensions and the quantity of the bags all worked out. I said, hell yeah, I'm on it. 6 months later, we turned to Rock Slide to introduce this set of bags and posted a call to action to help name the product. Response was incredible, and the bomb bags were coined. Boned out meat bags it is. And my sales increased 200% within the first 6 months. Meanwhile, TV shows and magazines like Eastman's and Meat Eater were voluntarily touting tag bags as the way to go. Sales increased again by 150% almost overnight. It was crazy. And actually, it makes me a little uncomfortable. I've kept tag bags' growth small and financially manageable since I created them by staying in that 6 to 8% target market reach. If you strive or accidentally achieve maximum growth potential, you've reached that 15 to 18% market share, which is critical because here is that tipping point which has the potential to launch your product into exponential profitable growth categories. This requires a lot of inventory and a lot more money for market-focused research and campaigns. I'm not interested in any of that because it conflicts with my backcountry lifestyle. If I'm too busy selling tag bags and spending money to do it, I lose time in the field, and that's counterproductive to my spiritual needs. These bags were created to be the lightest and smartest meat covers for my game meat, and they are all that. I have to sell them because they're so damn cool. As for the product, Tag Bags barely makes a profit, and that's by my own design. But the brand's quality and our customer service have secured a legacy brand that continues to shape the market with knockoffs like Caribou Gear and Kiyu game bags, selling the piss out of my intellectual enterprise. What's the biggest question I get from customers comparing Caribou Gear to tag bags? What makes mine different from theirs besides the reflective tape and material feel? Well, truthfully, nothing major. Ours are lighter and a little less expensive, and they're proven by innovation and science, but other than that, they're just a knockoff. It's easy for a knucklehead like Caribou Gear to take one of my bags to a textile company and ask them to ID the fabric and find a source, learn its thread count and its texture and finish, and then buy something very similar to be sold as your own brand of synthetic game bags. That's exactly what Caribou Gear seems to have done with tag bags, only he took it two steps further and copied the look of the orange stuff sack and made false claims on his website that he was the innovator who conceptualized synthetic bag material while on a float trip in Alaska. Mysteriously, that was around the same time frame as I was developing tag bags and selling low volumes in Alaska. He lied about the date of his conceptual brilliance by backdating his aha moment to a couple of years prior to my research posted on a public forum. He's never posted proof of any research or field studies he used to guide his decision on choosing the right material for caribou gear. So his backstory is sketchy as hell. What? Oh, man. He didn't even have the decency to change the field setting to something different than my own profession of float hunting in Alaska. What a loser, for which I have zero respect. If the general public decides to support companies like that, that speaks volumes for marketing influence. It's kind of like supporting a marathon runner who wins a race by cutting through the course and accepts personal victory while the other runners are busy laying down footprints the hard-earned way. Fuck that. So what happened with the recall? A bloody expensive lesson in dealing with overseas manufacturers is what that was. Because of the increased growth, I had to buy more raw materials to make tag bags. Domestic goods are expensive, damn expensive, but regulations on quality control are drastically more stable than anywhere overseas. I bought about 50,000 yards of non-domestic fabric and got burned on the finished goods. The first 100 or so rolls were solid and reliable, but as the production continued into the tail end of the fabric rolls, the quality and the finish diminished. A little backstory on raw goods is they have to have a final wash before being dried and rolled onto spools for shipping. This final wash decides the strength of the fabric. So, in other words, a good wash will result in you not being able to put your thumb through the fabric without the fibers opening up. One that has a shitty wash, like what you experience with those tag bag materials, is those seams will open right on up, man. It's dreadful. So that wash is expensive for manufacturers because it requires petroleum, acids, and a lot of toxic chemicals in the process. To cut corners, this wash isn't replaced as often or is diluted to just get by with reasonable goods to be sold to America. The problem with tag bags is that our sewing facility never identified a weakness in the material when they were producing the sets. It wasn't until about 10 months later, after the product had been on the shelves at Cabela's, Sportsman's Warehouse, Bass Pro Shop, Black Ovis, Rock Slide, and a variety of other storefronts in the Northwest, that I started to get calls. The one I remember the most was a guy who called me from his kill site, ranting about the bags that split open at the seams. His meat fell out onto the ground, right onto a huge pile of runny elk shit. Man, he was pissed. The next one came from a Cabela's customer who was standing at the point of sale bin, showing his buddy how strong tag bags were. He'd been using them for years with great success, and he brought his buddy in to show him how tough they were. He put his fist against the seam and pushed right through it. He called me in a panic. He was like, "Dude, I just put my hand through some of your tag bags trying to show my buddy how strong they were. What do I do?" I told him to run like hell. Nah, actually, while he was on the phone, I went out to the shop and opened up a few boxes and did some spot checks. All shitty seams. I was devastated. I decided to make it right with customers and replaced every bad set with a new one at my own expense. That decision, I believe, is what solidified my customer satisfaction and brand loyalty. So while it cost me $185,000, it proved to hunters that Tag Bags is a trusted brand with a solid backbone. It's the best $185,000 I ever lost. You gotta be kidding me. So logistics seem to be the name of the game in hunting in Alaska. Can you give your advice on how to tackle this for someone coming up outside of Alaska? I can sure try. So one thing I try to educate my hunters coming up for do-it-yourself Alaska trips is develop your mindset with logistics and cost. So if you had, you know, basically when we discussed logistics, you can come at this from two different perspectives: logistics ease and logistics cost. Two separate arguments. So in my opinion, the logistics ease is a lot more important than the cost. So I try to tell people, make decisions to make your time in Alaska go smoothly in terms of time and frustration. For example, you might decide to mail your non-essential, all your kit and your freeze-dried foods, everything. Mail those to your air taxi operator you know, 6 weeks ahead of your hunt, and that alleviates the need for, you know, wagging all your shit from airport to airport and hoping none of it gets lost or misplaced prior to your hunt. Because if you show up in Alaska and some of your bags don't, game over. And the bottom line is it costs a hell of a lot to operate in Alaska. So if you bring $500, maybe $1,000 of cash, $100 bills make problems disappear like smoke through a keyhole, motherfucker. So, Larry, I noticed a lot of your moose are killed in the water. Is floating a river the best way to hunt moose in Alaska? Well, it depends on what you want to get out of the hunt, actually. If you're wanting to just kill a moose, then really you're complicating your hunt plan by going river float versus ridgeline. I say that because some people want that experience as part of their memory of Alaska. Others are really focused on just getting a nice quality moose and learning the ropes without complicating it with a new task that they're sometimes unfamiliar with, like river floating and packing a raft and, you know, dealing with river chores. So I don't think it's the best way to hunt. I think it's a highly effective way to hunt because rivers and moose go together like, you know, stink on shit. Fuck. I choose to hunt along rivers because I like to smoke moose right down along the edge of the river. I don't want to pack them very far, and I've got the boats to float them out to safety, so it's a win-win for me. Can you tell us a little bit about the raft you designed and why? So the first, when I got up here in, it was the early 90s, I started float hunting up here in Alaska around 1995. The only thing that was available were things like the 14-foot Otter by NRS or, you know, these old-school Metzler rafts. And, you know, I started to see some Soar canoes. And, yeah, I really like the utility and function of that boat. So, basically, I approached Soar with a drawing of my ideal boat, which was, you know, it was called the Pro Pioneer. It's a 16-foot canoe that I virtually took a freighter canoe concept, created the tube diameter and the length with the depth of the floor and the width, and basically designed a boat that would give me a 1,500-pound capacity. And the closest thing to my concept was the Soar design. So I showed him a drawing of that on a cocktail napkin at the outdoor show in Anchorage, and I think that was in 2003. 6 months later, we had a prototype, and we called it the Pro Pioneer, and that took off. So that was a 16-foot canoe with a 46-inch width, 14-inch tubes. So it delivered quite a performance, but the problem was it was made of Hypalon and neoprene, both in the rubber family. When you compare what we knew then, as opposed to what we've learned today, plastics versus rubber, you get a much lower drag coefficient or coefficient of friction with plastics than you do with rubber. So over the years, I've evolved my personal theories about, you know, using inflatables as a barge to float out meat and gear. You need a boat that glides over the surface extremely well, and rubbers just didn't do that for me anymore. So there still was nothing like my concepts on the market. So I just continued to develop these strange ideas of, you know, longer boat, narrower width, and created these oversized tube designs that are high performance and high flotation. So they've been pretty popular. Basically, I design rafts that don't exist on the market because we need boats that go into shallow, narrow creek channels that have high flotation, so we're drifting over shallow riffles and shoals. The designs are a product of that need, and I believe the reason why we're successful today is because that philosophy hasn't driven the inflatable market, at least in the 30 years that I've been exposed to it. Most of the raft manufacturers are tailored to suit the whitewater adventurer. So these boats are wider and more stable, for carrying, you know, higher volume capacity of people and not necessarily weight. So whereas I come to the table designing a boat specifically with a weight demand in mind, one hunter, his gear, an entire bull moose, you need 1,100 pound capacity. If you had 1,500 or 1,800 pound, even better. So my designs are a product of that demand. We have designs from 9 foot packable 15 pound pack rafts all the way up to, you know, 15 foot, 9 inch raft that'll hold 3,000 pounds. So get on pristineventures.com and check out the products page under inflatable rafts and canoes. You'll learn everything you want to know about my inflatable designs. And there's a ton of YouTube videos on there that'll get your juices flowing, no doubt. Do I guide hunters in Alaska? No. Guiding never interested me. All the guides that I've known, unless they're operating on huge debts, only make $30,000 or $40,000 a year cleared. That wouldn't even pay for my lifestyle. So no, I've never been interested in guiding hunters. But I plan do-it-yourself adventures for hunters, and that hunt plan service is becoming increasingly popular. There's probably little chance that I'll still be doing it beyond 2020, and I'm already booked up to that date, so no need to call me for hunting advice. So meat care in Alaska can be difficult. Can you give us any tips on how to keep meat clean and cool on multi-day hunts? That's a huge discussion that you probably don't have time for in a podcast, or at least not this one. But I will say that the greatest knowledge that I have obtained is the working functions of temperature zones and how that relates to an environment of meat care. So temperature is something to focus on. If you want information on meat care, multi-day hunts in Alaska, I do some crazy projects and have some awesome videos that will break down this whole process from salvage to transport and preservation. Gives you everything you need to know about meat care in Alaska or any wilderness setting for that matter. Just check out some of our video resources and YouTubes. I think you'll learn as much as you want to know about meat care. Do I hunt with my dog very often? As often as possible. You know, I started to, you know, dogs are cool to hunt with. They're just great partners because, especially if you've got one that pays attention to nature, they're a second set of eyes and ears for you, and it can be quite advantageous. I've killed bear and caribou and moose and hunted sheep with them. They're good companions. Sometimes they make better partners than humans. Larry, I've seen a few videos where you've been on some backpack hunts. Can you tell us about the gear you use on those hunts? I'm really not an expert on backpack hunts. I'm too minimalistic to suggest certain items because it's, you know, it comes at a cost of comfort. So I think that's a personalized experience that folks just dial in every backpack hunt they do. That system gets tighter and sharper and lighter. And I'm still in that same process, so I don't think I'm qualified to give any advice there. I will say that a large part of my backpack kit is food weight. So if I had any advice to offer backpack hunters, I would say focus on your food kit, your nutritional standards to deliver a certain amount of calories in that 2,500 to 3,000 calorie per day allowance, and try to find the lightest possible foods that meet those caloric demands. And that's where you're going to see the most exponential weight savings in your pack. And overall, that's the advice that I would say is going to serve you better. What's your favorite caliber for hunting in Alaska? Well, if you would ask me that 5 years ago, I would have said a 30-06 because you can dial that thing down in weight grain to hunt small game and dial it all the way up to kill a polar bear. So 30-06 is pretty versatile in that respect. And you can find rounds pretty much anywhere in Alaska. So it's widely available if you're in the bush and run out of ammo or forgot it or, you know, somehow ended up needing it, you can find it. But today, I'd say that my favorite caliber is a 300 Weatherby Mag. A few years ago, Weatherby sent me a Vanguard 300 affixed with a Vortex HD razor, and I was immediately sold on that caliber once I started dropping animals. Do you carry a first aid kit? And if so, what is in it? Mine is pretty scant. I carry a roll of medical tape, hockey tape, and a bandana, Aleve, blood pressure medicine, Benadryl, and a healthy dose of weed. If you can't cure what ails you with that package, you better call an evac. Mm-hmm. Fuck.
Well, there's Larry Bartlett. I told you that would be entertaining. Obviously, Larry lives in a very remote place, so two-way communication would have been very difficult. So I just gave him a list of questions, and Larry hit it out of the park. You can find out more about Larry and tag bags and his rafts at pristineventures.com. And again, for me and Tanya, you can find us at averyadventures.com, Avery Adventures on Facebook, and Avery_adventures on Instagram. I apologize for my voice. I'm somewhat sick. And thanks for listening. See you on the next podcast.